Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today, being Christmas, I thought we would work in a religious theme of programs of 2011, some of the best programs where we dealt with the theme of religion, given that this day, of course, celebrates the birth of the prophet Jesus. Let's begin with the Harvard sociologist Robert Putnam, famous, of course, for his book Bowling Alone. He has explored the subject of religion in politics. And I'm speaking with Robert Putnam, who is the Peter and Isabel Malkin Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University and former Dean of the John F. Kennedy School of Government. He founded the Seguero Seminar, a program dedicated to fostering civic engagement in America. He is the author and co-author of a dozen books, including the bestseller Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community. Also, A Better Together, Restoring the American Community, and Making Democracy Work. His latest book with David Campbell is American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us, which examines the complex interaction of religion and politics over the past 50 years and assesses how religion both contributes and detracts from the vibrancy and stability of American democracy. Thank you so much for joining us today, Robert Putnam. Since I come from a different country, although I consider myself very much an American. I have a millennial American daughter who in many ways profiled or her attitudes and her friends' attitudes are tracked by your study, which we'll talk about in a minute. But one thing I've noticed is that in Europe, for example, in polite circles, the first thing that people discuss at a dinner party is their politics. The last thing that they discuss is what they discuss with their shrink and their most prurient details about their lives. Conversely, here in a dinner party or in a social gathering, people are free to talk about themselves in those kind of intimate ways. But the two subjects that seem to be verboten in polite societies in America are religion and politics, the very subjects that you've tackled. So explain that paradox.
Well, religion is a big deal in American society, much bigger deal here than it is in either Australia or Britain. Or most of the rest of the industrialized world. Americans are, in fact, if you judge that by how often they go to religious services or how firmly they believe in God, we're a little more religious, the average American, than the average Iranian. So although we don't have a theocracy here, America is a very religious country. What we're trying to do in this new book, American Grace, is to survey the last 50 years of religion in America. We've aimed to have the most comprehensive and the most in-depth survey of religion in the last 50 years that's been written in the last 50 years. And what's happened over this period, this last 50 years, is consistent exactly with your observation about conversational styles. We've become much more polarized in America, in religious terms. And yet, that's been counterbalanced by another trend that we talk about in the book, in which we've become more woven together across our religious lines. And so the theme of the book is, how can we, as a country, be both divided and united by religious ties?
But if we pull back to a global perspective, it would seem to me that what is noticeable about religion in the global context, at least the major monotheistic religions, is that within Christianity, we're very familiar with, particularly in this country, with Protestant fundamentalism and the growth of the evangelicals, etc. But we're less familiar, at least in discussions, with what seems to be fairly clear, is that the Catholic Church, particularly in the hierarchy in the Vatican, that's been captured by fundamentalists, arguably. And also, Jewish fundamentalists are certainly playing a role, as we know, in the West Bank with the notion that God is our realtor. And then you've got in Islam, undoubtedly, the malignant effect of the Wahhabi sect, fueled by Saudi Arabian petrodollars, have spread an extremely xenophobic version of Islam around the world, consequences of which, of course, were 9/11. So what is happening on a global scale that the two branches of Christianity seem to be captured by fundamentalism? The Jewish faith is at war with between not just the secular and the fundamentalists, but within Judaism, between Reform. Sure. And then you've got in Islam, the rise of the Wahhabis.
Well, It certainly is true that there has been this, on a global basis, as there has been inside the United States, a kind of a polarization on religious lines between the really deeply fundamentalist religions, you've described them accurately, and on the other hand, the deeply secular part of the society, which has also grown. And in America, at least, I can tell you a little bit about how that has evolved over the course of the last 50 years, what's happened here in the United States. What's happened globally is actually not really the subject of this book, but it's, I think, someone once said, in a strange country, you need maps, where the change in our lives across the world is pretty great, and therefore lots of people are wandering in strange territory, whether we're talking about Pakistan or Southern California or, you know, the West Bank. And in those strange lands, some people reach for a familiar map, that is the religious interpretation of what's happening around them. I think that's true in this country. I think it's true elsewhere too.
And it's not in the DNA. In other words, we were talking before we went on the air about Australia, and I, of course, quite often it comes up that, oh, you're descended from convicts. To which I reply, well, you're descended from religious fanatics.
Neither is quite right. I don't want to actually get into a debate here about the stain or non-stain on Australian history, but I am happy to have a discussion about the role of religion in the United States.
Yeah. No, in terms of the DNA, it doesn't go back to Plymouth Rock.
It's certainly not in our literal DNA. Mm-hmm. It certainly is true that national traditions matter, and the fact that America was established by religious dissenters, and not only the Puritans, but a whole bunch of other religious dissenters have come here over the years, is an important explanation for why religion in the United States is much more vibrant than it is in other advanced industrial countries. We have, for better or worse, had a lot of people here who were very religious, but no one of them was strong enough to establish itself as the single church. So we don't have a state church. Indeed, we have written into our Constitution the separation of church and state. It's not because our founders were particularly liberal people. It's that they were so diverse in their religion at the time that they couldn't agree on who's going to run things. And so they agreed, let's none of us run things. That has had the effect that America, quite unusually in the world, has a great deal of entrepreneurial spirit in its religion. By that I mean religious leaders throughout our history have been trying all sorts of new things, whether that's the mega church or Mormonism or Christian Science. We have invented more new religions and more new ways of doing religion than any other country in the world of the last 50 or 60 years, and that's over the last 200 years. And that's because religious leaders are constantly looking for new ways to appeal to people, and that has produced this effervescence of religious feeling across the whole of the U.S. Historical spectrum.
And is there an historical ebb and flow? In other words, many historians now and social scientists say that, and economists too, for that matter, argue that we, in many ways, the current situation parallels the Gilded Age, that we're mm-hmm. in a kind of new Gilded Age because of the growing disparity of wealth that was exhibited back at the beginning of the 20th century. And, of course, the titanic race back then was between Williams Jennings Bryan and McKinley, who represented the plutocrats. They outspent the populists, 200 or 300 to 1, very similar to what's happening today in terms of the huge influx of money into this current election compared to previous elections. So there are obvious parallels. But the distinction is that my understanding of the Williams Jennings Bryan race, and people may recall he was the Scopes trial against evolution, and yet he was the religious leader of a left-wing populism,
yes,
arguably. And now we have a right-wing populism. So
right.
Does it ebb and flow?
Indeed, it does. Both the amount of religiosity in America has ebbed and flowed over time, and its polarity with respect to politics, that is, whether religion is of the right wing or of the left wing, has changed a lot over American life. I myself think the parallel with the Progressive Era and our own time is really an important one. It actually was an important theme of my earlier book, Bowling Alone. There's a whole section in that book on this issue of the Progressive Era and our own time. But exactly as you say, the difference in religious terms between then and now is that religion was largely a progressive force in that period, I mean in terms of politics, and it's now been associated, but only fairly recently in our own time. We're so immersed in this culture wars that we kind of might think that this linkage between conservative politics and religion must always have been true in America. And it's actually only the last 20 or 30 years, historically in America, there's been essentially no major progressive movement throughout our history that didn't have an important religious motivation and religious organization at its core. So the American Revolution, egalitarian at the time, was rooted in the so-called first Great Awakening, which was an evangelical movement in the 18th century. The abolition movement among whites was rooted in the Second Great Awakening, which was an evangelical movement in the 1830s and 1840s. Much of the progressive era itself, as you were just saying, was very closely associated with religious motivation and religious organizations. The civil rights movement in America came out of first black churches and then increasingly white churches. So this period that we're now in which religion seems to be only about conservative politics, is quite novel in American history. I don't mean there are no precedents. There are, but it's the atypical rather than typical alignment between politics and religion.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Robert Putnam, who is professor of public policy at Harvard University, the former dean of the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and author of the bestseller Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community, and his brand new book, American Grace, co-authored with David Campbell, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. So, as you've just were saying, that we're in a different era from the progressive era when populism was on the left under William Jennings Bryan, and now it appears to be on the right. If you take, for example, a character like Glenn Beck, who, curiously enough, rails against the concept of social justice, which he argues is a front for communism. We can try and decipher that. Frankly, I'm at a loss. But your title, American Grace, of course, has echoes of the famous hymn, The Amazing Grace. And Wilberforce, of course, as he had his virtues, but he was also very conservative. And, for example, a very conservative group of senators here that are associated with this sort of house on C Street that has been in somewhat in the news, they apparently are adherents of a kind of prosperity gospel that's associated with Wilberforce, in the sense that Senator Coleman and others and Brownback believe that religion, that Christianity is in fact, there is virtue in wealth. There's virtue in the kings. I mean, and that's their book, Kings, as opposed to the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount.
Well, it's true that there is this linkage, certainly at the level of the political elite in America. I'm not entirely certain that I share your condemnation of Wilberforce. You've described a part of Wilberforce, but some of your listeners will also know that Wilberforce really was the person who ended slavery.
Yes, he did. And he ended the slavery, but I understand that he was extremely conservative in his politics. He certainly didn't believe in extending that kind of freedom, if you will, to the working class, did he?
I'm not trying to make Wilberforce either a saint or a sinner. I'm only trying to say that even in that case, there's complexity, and no doubt his opposition to slavery was rooted in part in his religious beliefs, as were the conservative parts of his politics.
Sure.
But to come back to America today, it certainly is true that you can find a little bit of everything on the religious right in America. You can find the prosperity gospel, as you say. Mm-hmm. You can find a lot of other things, including some pretty ugly things. But we, in the book American Grace that David Campbell and I have written, we're trying to look a little bit more at what the world looks like from the pews. And so we're more focused not on what any conspiracy is doing in terms of religion, but rather what ordinary people in the pews think.
Right.
And you can see in the pews, too, this polarization that I've talked about, largely over, however, issues of sex. There is not much difference between very religious people and very secular people in America on issues of the environment. There's actually not much of a difference between them on average. Obviously, individual people have different views, but on average, that's not much correlation between how you feel about the environment or how you feel about the death penalty or how you feel about immigration or even how you feel about you know, progressive income tax or other mm-hmm. progressive economic policies. There's a huge difference between the very religious part of our spectrum and the very secular people on fundamentally issues of personal sexual morality. So the obvious ones are abortion and more recently gay marriage and homosexuality. Actually, in a strange way, the strongest correlation of all of these issues is with how you feel about premarital sex. Premarital sex isn't a big public issue, but it is a big dividing line between people who are very religious and people who are not very religious. And as we tell the story of the this growing polarization of America over the last 50 years in America, we describe a series of shocks and aftershocks which have largely centered on issues of family values, as the as the right would call it, or personal sexual morality, and pushed one group of people who were in favor of the 60s off in a secular direction, another group of people in the 70s and 80s who were upset about the sexual revolution off in the in a more religious direction, and then in a second kind of aftershock in the 90s and more recently, another group of Americans, younger Americans, who were so upset about the religious right and its as they would see it, intolerance and homophobia, that they've left religion entirely. And so it I'm myself very interested in the social economic issues you're talking about. Sure. But what's at the core of this religious polarization is divisions over sexual morality and family values.
And another, we're going to have to wrap it up here, but you also found out that even fervently religious Americans believe that people of other faiths can go to heaven.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very generous of them. But
can I tell you an interesting story?
Sure.
I was having a conversation speaking to the annual theological conference of Missouri Synod Lutherans. Now, that's a particular sect in American religious life that is very fundamentalist. These are really the hardcore of fundamentalists.
Garrison Keillor would really make fun of them.
He
right?
would.
Yeah.
And I was speaking to the annual. They brought all the theologians together, and I talked about the same conversation you and I've had here. And some of the story they loved. Right. They loved the story about the religious people being nicer. They said, "Yeah, that sounds right to us."
Right.
But then I got to the point, which is true, and it's reported in our book, that when you ask Americans whether people who are a good person who is not of your faith can go to heaven, they say overwhelmingly, even people on the religious right say, yes, people not of my faith, a good person not of my faith can go to heaven. And then in the question we ask, we thought, well, maybe that's, you know, Methodists saying that Presbyterians can get in. So we said, if when we were talking to Christians and we said, you know, and they said, yes, people not of my faith can get into heaven. We said, well, you mean non-Christians? Can non-Christians get into heaven? And still, a very large majority of Christians say that non-Christians can go to heaven, and if they're good, and even a majority of evangelical Protestants say that non-Christians can get into heaven, even though every Sunday morning they read the Bible that says, Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the light. Except through me, there is no access to God. So it's perfectly clear what the right answer is from a religious point of view. And so in this meeting with theologians, that was the one finding that they were completely upset by, because they said it's not true that a good person who's not a Christian is going to get to heaven. So all these misguided people. But they said, fortunately, Missouri Synod Lutherans, our flock, they know the right answer. Well, it happened that I was speaking at a podium. I had my laptop. I had the data, the actual data on. And so in real time, I ran the numbers. And I reported to them that, yes, it was true that a majority of Missouri Synod Lutherans believed you didn't have to be Christian to go to heaven. Deep gloom covers the room.
Gloom is something that they're quite familiar with. Just in closing, though, Robert Putnam, I've often wondered about these arguments, particularly over prayer in school, whether people have completely missed the point here. I don't understand the injunctions against prayer in school. I mean, I understand them in the First Amendment context, but it seems to me that we can be much more nimble than that, surely. And it would make sense to me not to be hostile to religion in education, but rather to teach comparative religion. I think if people would, instead of religion being forbidden, if you could teach comparative religion across the board, I think it would do a lot to you know, your findings indicate that people actually are doing this in any case. They're starting to be more accepting. But don't you think that would be a better way to get rid of this polarization?
First of all, it's perfectly constitutional now, right now, for that to happen. There's no constitutional prohibition and no Supreme Court decision that says you can't teach about religion in school.
Right.
The provision that the courts have said is you can't actually practice religion.
Right.
You can't do religion in school. And that's what the issue about prayer is about. I'm not a constitutional lawyer, so I don't want to get too far into the details of that decision, but I do want to say that what you suggest seems to me very sensible, and the teaching about religion is entirely consistent with all the relevant Supreme Court decisions. So let's get about it.
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Robert Putnam.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you, Ian.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking further about religion in politics on this Christmas Day special.
Toys, death, the corals, mew. If you burn them all together, you get close to the truth still. They're pouring over Sanskrit under Ivy League moons while shadows lengthen in the sun. Cast on a school of meditation built to soften the times and hold us at the center while the spiral winds. It's knocking over fences, crossing property lines for winds.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is a Christmas Day special of Background Briefing, where we're looking into religion, given that this is a religious day, in effect, although it is somewhat commercialized. We'll now speak with Frank Schaefer, who grew up in a very prominent religious family. We spoke with him back on July the 25th of this year. Joining us now is Frank Schaefer, who is a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Ida Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. Frank Schaefer, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. Frank Schaefer's novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, and his latest, Sex, Mom, and God. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Schaefer.
Hey, thanks, Ian.
And clearly, given that this fellow Breivik, the mass murderer in Norway, in his manifesto cited a number of figures here in America, many of them associated with the phony controversy over the Ground Zero Mosque, Pamela Geller, and Daniel Pipes, the head of the United States Institute for Peace, Robert Spence of Jihad Watch. Actually, I think in the last interview I got him confused with some other fellow that has the gates of Vienna. Yeah. But the long and the short of it is some pretty creepy people are coming out of the woodwork. And I imagine being cited by a mass murderer is a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, you know, I think that the big issue here is less the individuals he cites, because, you know, he plagiarized a big chunk of Kaczynski's manifesto and changed a few words and made it his, and he talks about Christian Zionism and all the rest of it. I think the real story here is the overall context, the overarching similarity. Look, if you took his manifesto and you stripped out the loony bits about the Templar Knights and the Crusades and all the rest of it, and you just put his view of immigration or his view of homosexuality or his view of women's rights, or his view of Zionism and who should be on the West Bank and what should happen to the Palestinians, and you used it as a template and just laid it over the grid of what most Tea Partiers say they believe, or Michelle Bachmann says she believes, or the Republican Party stands for these days since it's been taken over by the religious right. I think the real story is the overarching context would be a match. Now, that doesn't mean in any way that I'm implying blame to either individual authors or politicians who would genuinely, from their heart, abhor what he did. But I am saying that the temper of the times we live in seems to me to indicate that the extreme action he took really comes out of a milieu which is a much bigger picture of xenophobia, homophobia, misogyny, Zionism run rampant in terms of the Christian community, people like John Hagee and this big church in Houston, you know, calling essentially for the elimination of the Palestinians in the Holy Land, perhaps not literal elimination, but certainly pushing them out of the borders. That's the context. So, you know, when you look at the actions of a mass murderer, and if it's a Ted Bundy or a Hillside Strangler, whomever, that's one kind of thing. If you look at a senseless act of, you know, random car bombing by the Islamic jihadists, that's another kind of thing. This murder is something different. It's a very specific political act, deliberately fomented to try to generate race war. And it's something that has been well thought out and planned for years and has a manifesto attached to it. And its context is not in a vacuum. His views don't stand out like a sore thumb. His views would fit in with run-of-the-mill right-wing Christian views on almost every issue, both in America and Europe. So that's the shocker to me. It isn't that he quotes this or that person. The shocker is that the context of this killing is a political act which gives, you might say, in a horrible way, flesh and blood to what for so many people is just talk, but is drawn from the same vile cesspool of reaction and bigotry as what we would now call mainstream movements. And I hate to put it this way, mainstream to the point that these are the views of the Republican Party, not on killing, but on foreigners, on immigration, and all the rest of it. I think that's the shocker. The shocker is just this general context to me.
Well, Frank Schaefer, you don't have to go that far in the sense that ascribing I'm not criticizing your accuracy, but I'm just saying that that you don't even have to go that far with the Republican Party now captured by the Tea Party to see this extraordinary economic hostage crisis that they're pulling off in Washington, D.C., where they're risking the full faith and credit of the United States. They're prepared to bring the whole house down, having a political tantrum, trying to extort concessions so that they get 100% of their way. Well, that is, by any definition, extreme behavior.
Yeah, and what you see there is, you know, something that I was writing about on a piece that I did for Alternet this week, and was repeating again today with Martin Bashir on MSNBC, and that is that when you look at what's happening with the Republicans in Congress today, what you are looking at is faith-based politics. This is not about economics. It's not even about politics. It is about a religious conviction on the fact that, from their point of view, the U.S. government is illegitimate because it has not followed their moral teachings on everything from abortion to women's rights, to education, to gay rights. And the agenda of the Republican Party now, with people like Michelle Bachmann in the fore, or Rick Perry in Texas calling his prayer meeting on August 6th, is an agenda that, again, if you're looking for overlaps and a pair of spectacles to look at this through, the only pair of glasses that really works to understand what the Republicans are doing in Congress tonight is the Ayatollahs in Iran, and that is, it's a kind of a theocratic view of the world. So from their point of view, the U.S. government is evil because it no longer represents what they would call Judeo-Christian values at every turn. It has to be defunded, you know, starve the beast, as Ronald Reagan put it way back when. And their viewpoint is not one of trying to do what's good for the United States of America, much less the world economy, or to get very personal, you know, my pension and savings and yours. They are jihadists in their own way, and that is, it's a scorched earth policy. It's my way or the highway, and they will take us all with them. And when you add race into this, and too few people tell the honest truth on this, the heat and fire in the Tea Party and the Republicans today, from my point of view, over half of it doesn't even come from politics. It's just anger that they have at seeing a black man more intelligent than they are, more articulate and certainly more compassionate, sitting in the White House. This kind of entitled white man's club has been changed. when you add that mix in, you know, they are carrying out with religious fervor and conviction what Rush Limbaugh said before Obama even took office, and that is, I hope he fails. And they've done everything they can to destroy his presidency. And what amazes me about Obama is that he's managed to get anything done when he faces an opposition that has nothing to do with politics and everything to do with religious conviction about the direction of this country and trying to replace the Constitution and the Bill of Rights with what they would view as God's law on things like abortion, women's rights, gay rights, but even international policy, where they feel they can fight wars of choice based on lies, for instance, in Iraq, and they're entitled to do this because of their conviction about American exceptionalism. Somehow we're special. The rules don't apply to us. So touch it where you may, the Republican Party is in the hands of extremists. And even people like David Brooks, who's a conservative, middle-of-the-road Republican commentator for the New York Times commentator from the right, as they would see it, you know, he writes a few weeks ago that the Republican Party can no longer be considered a normal political party, that it has become something else. It's not even a political party anymore, and that's how far it's gone. If you can get David Brooks to essentially read you out of normal politics and call you something abnormal, you've really managed to do something here, and that's what the Tea Party has brought us to.
Again, I'm speaking with Frank Schaefer, the author of Sex, Mom, and God. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked for such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. He, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. Now, just in terms, though, of the specifics of the anti-Muslim stuff, going back to the Ground Zero Mosque phony controversy, which is about as phony as the debt crisis is, and as much as it was ginned up for political reasons. And of course, Rupert Murdoch's New York Post fanned the flames. Those people, as we mentioned, have been cited by the Norwegian mass killer. But there's one Republican candidate, by the way, who I think fits the bill in terms of this Islamophobia and these outrageous racist statements that are fanning the flames of interfaith tensions, and that is Herman Cain.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, he's not alone. Look, there's two kinds of Republican leadership today. Cain is one, Bachman is one, and then there are the other people who, you know, are quote-unquote mainstream. But listen, when you are, look, it's a degree of hostage-taking. The whole country has been taken hostage by the Republican Party. That's simply true. The Republican Party has been taken hostage by the religious right. And in the Republican Party, there's two kinds of Republicans, with a lot of gray ones, you know, undefined in the middle, but two on the extreme. One is, you know, the good old boys club that don't care at all about the social issues or even the Republican agenda. They're just in the pocket of the Koch brothers and et cetera, et cetera. Those guys, you know, would not let the Tea Partiers even caddy for them on their golf club if they ever actually met one in the flesh. But they have to play along because the primary-based election system in this country for politics means that they will be primaried on state level or national level and beaten by this vociferous group of people who have taken over the party. So what the Tea Party has done to the Republican Party is now doing to the whole country. And they're doing it on two levels. One, the true believers like Bachman and Cain, and then secondly, or Rick Perry, and then secondly, the people who are not true believers, and it's just business as usual, but they have to use these rubes, as they would think of the Tea Partiers, to get what they want in the primaries, and then they go on, and when they're elected, of course, they do nothing on any of their issues. What they do is they simply take care of their billionaires club and make sure that their friends aren't paying taxes. And those are that's what's left of the Republican Party. You know, Bill Buckley, roll over in your grave, or former John McCain, you know, look in the mirror and apologize. I mean, the Republican Party, agree or disagree, was not always in the hands of a combination of extremists and Rand groupies and Bible-thumping fundamentalists on the one hand, and people who had no interest or agenda other than taking care of their billionaire stock traders. That's where it's come to.
Well, Frank Schaefer, I know that you're concerned, and you see an analogy here with the Norwegian mass murder in terms of similar currents here in the United States, in as much as the religious right and Christian fundamentalists here in the United States equate godliness with hatred of government. And
sure.
And that is, I think, a subject that's worth exploring. And furthermore, when you talk about abortion and the so-called pro-life movement, which it ends up being corrupted to the point where you have killers of abortion providers like the killer of Dr. Frank Tiller a couple of years back. And so the thing that I find particularly disturbing about that phenomenon is that it's ultimately about a moral free ride. It means that you can actually care passionately about, for example, about the life of a fetus, which, you know, pro-life is a much more powerful concept than pro-choice. It gets to the heart of a deep emotional and moral truth. So, but at the same time, the idea that because you care so much about unborn babies, that gives you the right to kill another human being, in this case, in his own church, is sort of, I think, I'm not trying to make a reach here, is kind of the mentality of this guy that went out and killed these kids, because he thought that he had a higher calling that sanctioned the killing of these kids. So how do you go that extra step from being a legitimate pro-life activist and killing an abortion provider?
Well, I think you've outlined it very well, and it's not an accident that in my new book, Sex, Mom, and God, I take two chapters and really unpack both the history, the direction, and what happened to the so-called pro-life movement. Look, it would not have started without my dad and I working on these things back in the 70s, not in terms of a Protestant pro-life movement, and then we teamed up with Dr. C. Everett Koop, who then became Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General, and so forth and so on. And so in this area, I was on the inside, and I think I know what I'm talking about, and try to explain how this became a watershed movement. But the thing that you said is absolutely true. Look, if you have a basic religious or moral conviction that you are completely right and everybody is completely wrong on an issue and there are no gray areas, and then you go the next step and you demonize your opponents so they are no longer rational people that you can disagree with, discuss with, perhaps learn from, who might even change your mind on something if they present an argument. They are just the other. They are demonic. They are wicked. You see, that's what's happened, and that transfer has been made to the whole U.S. government. The pro-life so-called community does not regard the U.S. government as legitimate. They regard it as illegitimate, or to put it in the words of my father, Francis Schaeffer, in his book, A Christian Manifesto, the U.S. government is the same as Hitler's Germany. And he said that because of his views of abortion. Well, as soon as you've said that, you know, if your president is like Hitler, if your government's like Hitler, what does that open the door to doing? You know, firebombing cities, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. I mean, where would the limit be to get rid of this evil if that's how you have delegitimized your own country, your own government? So when these people talk about being anti-government, you have to understand that in the context of a democracy, that means they are anti-American. That means they hate their country, and they do. They like a fictionalized America where there would be no gay people, no immigrants. Everyone would live the way they do. You know, they would be in home schools with their children or small Christian academies. There would be no public education. That's the America they love, and they try to create it on an individual basis. The rest of us, you know, to put it in Sarah Palin's words, are not real Americans, and she and her followers would be real Americans. So when you get to that point, when your opponent is no longer human, but someone who is illegitimate simply because they hold views you disagree with, and therefore, you know, they don't exist on the same level you do, you can kill them. And that's where abortion provider murders do their acts. That's why this guy drove his plane into an IRS building. He so hated the government. This is why the Houthi militia was training to kill policemen. I mean, think about that. The right wing is supposed to be all about, you know, cops and flags and you know, young Marines and the rest of it. The Houthi militia, in the name of Jesus, was training to kill American service people. in order to hasten the apocalypse. And we've got secessionist movements running around the country in the woods, you know, training with automatic weapons. What for? Well, for Second Amendment remedies.
We've also got very likely that the governor of Texas, a secessionist, will be running for president. I'm afraid we've run out of time here, Frank Schaefer, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, it's always my pleasure, Ian. Thanks a lot.
Again, I've been speaking with Frank Schaefer, author of Sex, Mom, and God. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking further about the role of religion in politics. Welcome back. I'm Ian Master. This is Background Briefing. Let's now go to an interview that I did fairly recently on December the 6th, further on the role of religion in politics. Joining us now is James Kloppenberg, who's the Charles Warren Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. His books include Uncertain Victory, Social Democracy and Progressism in Europe and American Thought, 1870 to 1920, The Virtues of Liberalism, A Companion to American Thought, and his new book, Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Kloppenberg.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And today the president declared the middle class in jeopardy and outlined a populist economic vision calling for a fair shot and a fair share. And clearly he was channeling, shall we say, President Theodore Roosevelt, since he was in the same place where Roosevelt gave a speech in 1910, where he called for a square deal for regular Americans. Do you think this is...
It's a good point, and he is quite clearly trying to hearken back to a very progressive Republican president. When Roosevelt ran in 1912, he ran as a third-party candidate, as the Progressive Party candidate, but he had served indeed as president as a Republican. And in calling for a square deal, he was advancing the cause of most of the reformers in the multifaceted movement that was called progressivism. And I think what President Obama is trying to do is to rekindle that progressive spirit.
Well, Roosevelt went further, I think, in that particular speech that the president is echoing. He said the fight for progress was a conflict between the men who possess more than they have earned and the men who have earned more than they possess. Pretty powerful, simple framing, I'd say.
It is powerful, and it not only harkens back, Obama's speech not only harkens back to Teddy Roosevelt, it harkens back further than that to Abraham Lincoln. People sometimes forget today that language of earned income was the language of most Americans from the 18th century through the 19th century and into the 20th century. The notion that income that is earned from other sources is somehow legitimate is a fairly recent phenomenon in American history. And the notion that attacking that unearned wealth is somehow un-American or populist or a version of class warfare strikes most historians as almost comic, because this has been the central line of American thought on politics and economics for a very long time.
Well, of course, Theodore Roosevelt was an accidental president, and in many ways, comparisons have been made to the Gilded Age, where McKinley represented the plutocrats against William Jennings Bryan, who were then the populists. And of course, the irony was in those days, populism amongst the rural poor and the urban poor was in many ways reposed in religion. In other words, you had a religious left back then.
You did, and we've had a religious left in America ever up until very recently. I mean, that was one of the striking things about reform in America for much of our history, that the most radical people economically have been, in many cases, the most fervently Christian, and the notion that somehow inequality has become the ideology of American Christians, again, strikes historians as a very peculiar development, because it's certainly not the way things played out in the 19th or the first half of the 20th century.
So, James Kloppenberg, do you believe that the president can put history back in its rightful place and revive this? I take it you consider this a dormant movement?
Well, I wouldn't even call it dormant. I think it's the position that he took in 2008. In fact, it's the position that he took in the second of his two books, The Audacity of Hope. And anyone who has read that book will recognize the speech today as coming straight out of Obama's analysis of American history and American politics in that very fine book. So I think he is simply returning to the strategies that he adopted that got him elected to the Senate from Illinois and that he took with him to Washington. I think since his election to the presidency, he's tried very hard to work with the Republican Party and has tried to be a compromiser, a conciliator, someone who could find common ground, because that's the way he thinks democracy should work. And the Republicans have demonstrated now through all of his presidency that they don't see it that way, that they would prefer to be obstructionists. So I think he has learned his lesson, in my sense, is that this is the opening speech of the 2012 presidential campaign.
So, James Kloppenberg, is that to say then that this forthcoming election, you know, we've got a whole year plus to go, but could it be therefore framed around a kind of religious left and a religious right? There's no question that the religious right has tremendous power within the Republican Party, and particularly in the nominating process, they control the Iowa caucus effectively. And as you can see, most of the candidates are kowtowing to them. With the exception of Romney, who's a Mormon and is therefore not particularly welcomed by the religious right. So if they can have a litmus test on that side, why not the president, in effect, use the real ammunition in the Bible? Because after all, the prophet Jesus ministered to the poor. He didn't carry an AK-47, he didn't hate homosexuals, and he didn't go on television asking for money.
Exactly so. You're quite right, and this tradition of what is called the social gospel in America has had a long and distinguished history, and Obama himself has aligned himself with that tradition that originates in the late 19th century and gathers momentum up to the middle of the 20th century. And as far as he's concerned, I think the way you put it is exactly right, that this is a tradition that historically sided with the disfranchised. It sided with the poor and the downtrodden. And I think what he wants to do is to remind American Christians that this is a gospel of benevolence that they claim to believe in and not a gospel of greed and selfishness. And I think calling Americans back to that older reading of the gospel is, from my perspective, a very strong argument for him to make. Again, this is something he's been committed to for a very long time. It comes through both in his autobiography and in his second book, and it's an understanding of Christianity that I think has very deep roots, as you understand, and I think what he's trying to do is just to remind people of that.
Again, I'm speaking with James Kloppenberg, who is professor of American history and chair of the history department at Harvard University and author of the new book, Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. Well, clearly, I don't know how religious Theodore Roosevelt was, but he sure shook up the big trusts. I referred to him earlier as a sort of accidental precedent, in as much as McKinley was assassinated, and he was clearly put on the ticket to balance out the plutocrats' dominance of the party at that time. I take it he took a lot of people by surprise. What more can the president learn from Theodore Roosevelt in terms of mimicking him?
Well, I'm not sure that there's a whole lot more for him to learn, because the trajectory of their two careers is so different. I think the conception that there is nothing anti or un-American about calling for greater equality and calling for a square deal, as Roosevelt did, is a theme that President Obama will do well to recover. I think that the Republicans have been arguing for quite a while that there's somehow something illegitimate about this call for equality. And I think it's striking in the audacity of hope that President Obama notes that when Thomas Jefferson came back from writing the Declaration of Independence, the first thing he did when he got home to Virginia was to file legislation to end the two practices that had preserved great wealth in Europe, primogeniture and entail. These were the methods by which European aristocrats maintained their fortunes. And America began with an assault on that notion of passing down fortunes from one generation to another. So the idea that there is something un-American about a challenge to inequality that has become stifling, which is what we face in our own day, is a fantasy. It's a myth. And I think the president knows enough about American history to make that clear. So when self-styled historians such as Newt Gingrich spin out their fantasies about American history, I think this is a president who actually has the goods, who will be able to call them on it and offer facts rather than fantasies of American history.
So, James Kloppenberg, do you think the president was clever in choosing the site, clearly aimed at echoing Theodore Roosevelt, and choosing a lot of the language that Roosevelt gave in 1910 about inequality being the defining issue of our time? And you know, of course, that the Republicans have already been accusing him of being a socialist, and at least some of them are running and anti-American and not even an American. We know all of the poisonous stuff that's been said, but clearly they've been trying to tie him to the Occupy movement that the world's highest paid historian Newt Gingrich refers to as a bunch of people who need a bath. He, I think, deftly tied himself to that movement via Roosevelt, didn't he?
Well, I think what he's trying to do is to call attention to the same issue that has been animating most of the occupiers, which is the issue of increasing inequality in America. And I don't see that as an issue that is the issue of the occupiers alone. That's an issue that many people in the Democratic Party have been calling attention to for a very long time. In the 1912 election, it was not only Theodore Roosevelt who was contesting that, but also his successor, William Howard Taft, and Woodrow Wilson. And in that election in 1912, one could argue that all of the major candidates had gotten on board with this program of graduated income tax, of economic regulation, of minimum wage, an eight-hour day, which were innovations at the time. And I think that that was the moment when the old notions of laissez-faire really did come to an end, and that was the moment in which every party had embraced the idea of progressive politics and progressive economics. So I think what the president is trying to do, and you may be right that this is a shrewd move on his part, is to remind Republicans that their own party has in its background moderates who were not opposed to a graduated income tax, who were not opposed to economic regulation, and who believed that inequality was a serious problem for everyone in the United States, not just something that appealed to the great unwashed, as the Republican Party candidates this year are trying to pretend it is.
Well, it's, relatively recently, President Eisenhower, a Republican, in his day, the wealthiest Americans paid 92% in income tax. Now they pay 35%, and the Republicans are offering them less.
So right. No, it's true.
Times have changed.
And, President Obama made the point in his speech today that he's not even talking about returning to those days of 80 and 90% marginal tax rates at the very top. He's talking only about returning to the Clinton years when the top marginal tax rate was 39%. And I think as the year unfolds, he will remind the American people that the years of the greatest economic growth in the United States were the years from the New Deal up through 1980, when tax rates were much higher than they are today. And again, the mythology that somehow high taxes mean no economic growth and low taxes mean great economic growth is simply not borne out by the facts. We had much greater economic growth during those years. We even had much greater economic growth during the Clinton years than we've had since the Bush tax cuts. And the notion that we should go back to a situation that has been proven not to work for the vast majority of Americans, so that the situation that worked very, very well for the top 1 or 2% can continue as it did during the Bush years, is to me an extraordinarily anti-American ideology. And yet the challenge to that ideology is being called un-American. And I think what the president is trying to do is to remind his listeners that this tradition of challenging inequality is as old as the United States, and it has distinguished champions as they go back as far as Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, and include Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt, as well as Franklin Roosevelt.
And in terms of the Occupy movement, the president said throughout the country it sparked protests and political movements from the Tea Party to the people who've been occupying the streets of New York and other cities. Again, I think cleverly tying the Tea Party in with the Occupy movement. Just in closing, what's your sense of how much the Occupy movement is going to translate into a political movement, particularly in terms of electoral politics, James Kloppenberg?
It's very hard to say. It's the case that very successful social protest movements begin in just the inchoate way that the Occupy movement is beginning, but it's also the case that unsuccessful social protest movements begin the same way. I think it's too early to say. I think by calling attention to the issue of inequality, they've helped advance the progressive cause by forcing people to confront this problem. And to that extent, I think they might provide impetus toward a renewed progressive reform movement, and I think that President Obama could ride that sentiment to re-election in the White House. But unless the movement broadens itself and translates into a campaign to elect a Democratic Congress, it won't necessarily make as much difference as we might think it would, because we discovered from 2010 until the present that if the president does not have majorities in the House and the Senate, it's very difficult to get anything done. So no matter how progressive his own agenda might be, and anyone who's read his books knows that he is indeed a progressive, not a radical, but a moderate progressive, someone who would like to move one step at a time toward a more egalitarian culture, unless he has the support of a strong Congress, as Franklin Roosevelt had in the 1930s and 40s, as Lyndon Johnson had in the 1960s, it's very difficult for a progressive party, for a progressive president to get much done. So it's important to call attention to these issues. It's important for the president to do everything he can to assure his reelection. But in the absence of a Democratic Congress, all of that will not mean as much as it might otherwise.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, James Kloppenberg.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with James Kloppenberg, who's the Charles Warren Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. His books include Uncertain Victory, Social Democracy and Progressivism in European and American Thought, 1870 to 1920, The Virtues of Liberalism, A Companion to American Thought, and his new book, Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. This has been a special background briefing, a Christmas edition, if you will, where we look back at some of the interviews we did in 2011 that talked about religion, particularly religion in politics, given, of course, that Christmas is, in effect, a religious holiday, although it has been monstrously commercialized. I hope all of you are having a wonderful Christmas, and we'll be back in the next few days of this week, each day dealing with a different subject that was prominent in the news in 2011. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And we'll be back again tomorrow with the best of 2011. Bye for now.